is all good?
Everybody's hanging in there. We've stayed safe somehow.
You're a survivor.
Survivor. You said you reread our book. My goodness.
Yeah.
Well, you probably know it better than I do now.
All right. Well, you can ask me questions about it, and here we go. Brothers and sisters, welcome to a very exciting interview with two people that I'm just so thrilled to spend some time with, Dr. Brian Hare and Vanessa Woods, and we'll talk about the hare in the woods later, but they just wrote a fantastic new book, kind of new, Survival of the Friendliest, yes, Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity, woohoo! And I'm so excited to talk about this book because, well, I've known Vanessa, I'm going to take off my bonobo mask for this, because, yes, I've known her since I interviewed her in 2010 about her book, The Bonobo Handshake, which if you watch the Dr. Susan Block show, you know what a bonobo handshake is, right? But after our interview, Vanessa turned me on to Sex at Dawn by Dr. Christopher Ryan, to Lola Ya Bonobo and the heroic Claudine Andre, to her cool sister, Bronnie, and she also gifted me with a great review for my book, The Bonobo Way. And if you look at the Kindle version, those photos are mostly hers. So she is incredible, simply amazing, a very friendly human, which is why this is a good title, and a great writer, really. The Bonobo Handshake, it's about the Democratic Republic of Congo's incredibly complex and devastating ongoing wars, as well as the only great ape who doesn't murder, let alone make war, and that would be the bonobo. Of course, I've been in love with bonobos for a long time, since 1993, which was 15 years before I read Bonobo Handshake, but it really deepened my love for our kissing cousins, yay, the bonobos who swing from the trees as well as with each other. But I really appreciated Vanessa's deep understanding of bonobos, and also, unlike a lot of primatologists and other experts and media people, Vanessa impressed me because she wasn't afraid to talk about bonobo sex, you know.
It's like 3 in the morning, Eastern time, and I was like, Yes. One of my favorite interviews ever.
Aw, thank you. And here she is, just barging in like a bonobo into my illustrious introduction, but that's perfectly wonderful. Just swing on in here. Vanessa Woods. Her co-writer on this book, Survival of the Friendliest, is the illustrious Dr. Brian Hare, who I feel like I've known as long as Vanessa, because he's like the leading man in Bonobo Handshake, and he's also the fall guy, you know, for all Vanessa's problems, and yeah, he's a great hubby. And then when Vanessa actually got too busy with her kids, because, you know, occasionally sex does lead to kids, well, Dr. Brian just stepped in and answered all of my kind of silly questions about bonobos and what's the research, what does it mean, as well as really sympathized with me when I got so upset that Dawn of the Planet of the Apes portrayed Koba, the most violent ape, as a bonobo, and that was so bad, and Brian calmed me down. Gosh, these two have just really exemplified this title. And they have another book called The Genius of Dogs, because they're into dogs. I don't know if it's as much as bonobos, it's in a different way, but this title, Survival of the Friendliest, is truly genius. I just want to give a little credit to Brian, the Dr. Brian Hare, world-renowned biological anthropologist, Duke University professor of evolutionary anthropology, founder and director of the Duke Canine Cognition Center, Dognition, and really science superstar. So between the two of them, Vanessa, award-winning journalist and science researcher, and Dr. Brian Hare, we're just overwhelmed with bonobo and dog expertise. And also both worked with one of our favorite primatologist anthropologists, Dr. Richard Wrangham, who has a place of honor here in Bonoboville, being one of the first anthropologists to dare to come on my show to talk about bonobos, for which he actually said he almost lost his job at Harvard. But he did great. So Brian and Vanessa have both worked with Dr. Richard, and they've come up with this fantastic book, Survival of the Friendliest. So welcome to the Dr. Susan Block Show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susie. It's so fun to be with you again.
So much fun. And it's been like that, but it's been, you know, 15 years, I think, or
you look
10
exactly
years, 12 years. Yeah.
You look exactly the same.
So do you. Although we did a radio interview before, so we're forgiven if we add or subtract a few years. So it's so good to have you here, and I did want to see you guys. Where are you? You're in different places. Well, you don't have to give an exact address.
But Vanessa, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, with the two children who are the product of sex that we had a while ago.
Right.
And so they had to go to school.
Two times.
And I had to come back for testing a little puppy that we have at the Duke Puppy Kindergarten. And Brian, where are you?
I am in the mountains of North Carolina in a cabin.
Oh, a cabin in the woods, eh? Well, a hare in the woods, going back to your sex. Before we get back to your sex, let's talk about the title of this book, because it is a genius title. There's a great ring to it, Survival of the Friendliest, and you feel, you know, like you've heard it before, but really what you've heard is that great phrase of Charles Darwin's, survival of the fittest. And we don't usually think of fittest as being friendliest. We think of that as like physical fitness or maybe being really, really smart or just really, really competitive or aggressive or powerful. But as you say, that is not really what survival of the fittest means. And in fact, it means friendliest.
Yes, so you're exactly right. Fitness is, as Charles Darwin meant it, was just your ability to reproduce. And Darwin saw so many examples of friendliness in nature where, you know, it was a best strategy. It was a winning strategy. And so, you know, over time, this phrase is being convoluted with, you know, the meanest and the strongest and the most physically fit. But, you know, in the 19th century, that's not what it meant. And I think it's a shame because the original meaning is just so much more powerful than that.
Right. So survival of the fittest, it doesn't mean of the most powerful. It might mean of the sexiest, right? Because after all, it is about reproduction. You got to get
there. Well, you can't reproduce without sex, as you pointed out. So yes. Yes.
A little bit of natural selection there. It's very heartening, I feel, especially in this day and age when we're grappling with, are we a community, we humans, or is it one team against the other, one country, one race, one gender against the other? And to find out that survival of the fittest doesn't really mean it's all about the competition. In fact, to a great degree, it's about cooperation, isn't it?
Yeah, so most of the big evolutionary jumps, when you step back and you look at all of nature, And you look at sort of where species have made big jumps in success, it's always a story about a new type of friendliness evolving that leads to a new form of cooperation. So you can look at anything from flowering plants that are a relatively new type of plant, and they're providing a gift of food for pollinators to take their sexual material around and allow them to sexually reproduce better. And they've spread all over the world and have outcompeted many other plants. You can look at, there is one terrestrial vertebrate that stays in Antarctica year round, other than humans, a native, which is those big, beautiful emperor penguins. And the secret to how they do that is they huddle together all winter. So they are attracted to each other, they hug each other all winter, and they stay warm. So this type of friendliness of staying close and hugging is what allowed them to win and be the only species that's a vertebrate that can be in Antarctica all year round. And bonobos are another example of this. The most successful bonobo male is more successful at having offspring than the most successful chimpanzee, even though chimpanzees are very despotic and very aggressive, and have many of the darker traits that we fight in our own species.
Yeah, well, you know, nice guys finish first in Bonoboville.
That's right.
So you're talking about the flowers and the plants cooperating with the animals, and ants, of course, cooperate. Not your aunts and uncles. They probably don't cooperate so much. But the ants in the anthills. This is a key to human success. I mean, you talk about how we broke off from the bonobos and the common chimps, we humans, about 6 million or 9 million years ago. And then there were a bunch of other species that were kind of like us, like Neanderthals and Homo erectus. And we kind of kept going while they died off, not because we beat them up, but because we cooperated, because we were friendly with each other and we knew how to build things and get places. Is that kind of a synopsis?
Right. That's exactly right and put so well. The question that we are usually asking is that, you know, what does it make us human? But another question that's equally important and just as mysterious is what is that makes us the human? Because as you said, there are at least four other human species in the time that modern humans or Homo sapiens have been around. And what was it that allowed us not just to thrive, but to flourish? And why aren't there any other Neanderthals walking around right now? And, you know, usually the Neanderthals are a great example because they were bigger than we were. They were stronger. They had brains that were at least just as big as ours. Maybe they were even bigger. They had culture. There's some evidence they had language. They had all the same toolkit that we did. So if it wasn't technology and it wasn't their strength, then, you know, why did we win? And you're exactly right. We think it was because we have a unique form of cooperation and we were able to cooperate in ways and be friendly within between groups in ways that the other humans could not. And that's why we're here.
Right. And sometimes you call this ability to cooperate and to socialize a kind of self-domestication. And we're going to talk more about how bonobos and dogs do this. We're so excited to talk about bonobos and dogs, two of our favorite species. Oh, besides human, we love our fellow humans too. But there is a flip side that I just want you to mention to at least human nature, and that is that when you're really nice and friendly with your in-group, you might be kind of mean to people that you consider in the out-group. The flip side of friendliness is this terrible cruelty that we also find in humanity. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so when you look at humans, what we think the type of friendliness that allowed us sort of outcompete all the other humans that weren't as friendly as we are was an attraction to strangers who we could see as having some signal of being in our group. So even though we'd never met, even though you may not have met somebody before, maybe they speak the way you do, maybe they like to eat the food you do, maybe they wear their hair the way that you do, and you can instantly be friends with them. They can be, you recognize them as part of your group. But the problem is that while we have this new type of friendliness, it allows us to expand our social group. We can learn from more individuals. It means that our technology can go more rapidly than the other species of humans who were not attracted to these types of strangers. In fact, they were just afraid of all strangers. The problem is that while we began to love our in-group, even strange in-group members who we just meet and became friends with, we begin to love them as if they're family. Well, then when they're threatened, we want to protect them. And when the thing that scares us the most is when they're threatened by a group that's not our own group, an out-group. And so we have, while we have psychology to be super friendly, we also have psychology to protect that in-group we love. And if our identity is threatened, that in-group identity is threatened, then potentially the worst or darker side of our nature comes forward. So then the question becomes, well, how do we keep that from happening?
Right. And that's a lot of what your book gets into. It's not all bad to protect those you love and to have a sense of defending yourself, but often it does seem to get out of control in our society, especially after the agricultural revolution, where farming has led to capitalism, has led to all this crazy competition that maybe we're not really cut out for, we humans, but we're doing it. And so here we are grappling with each other and trying not to get each other's diseases, and some of us are shooting each other, and some of us are dropping bombs on each other, and this is all bad. So we want to try to be, what I would say, more bonobo, or just, let's say, more peaceful and more understanding, more friendly. And you get into various exercises and games and things that people can do and play, especially young people, like these jigsaw arrangements, which I will say is also done now more and more among adults when we have conventions, is we don't just give a dissertation on something. We might break up into groups and the group has to solve a problem. And when everybody in the group has to solve a problem, you have to be nicer to all the people in your group or you don't get your problem solved. And this kind of teaches you that friendliness that you're talking about here.
So what Brian was talking about with when you're threatened by someone who's not part of your group, who you don't see as part of your group, this has happened throughout human history. And what you were talking about in the book is the best and one of the only ways, because we've understood this part of our nature for hundreds of years. And so, you know, people have been coming up with all sorts of solutions, like what is it we do? How do we, you know, get over this dehumanization ability that we have? And one of the only things that social psychologists and others have found is that becoming friends with someone from another group is one of the quickest way to short circuit that dehumanization and to see them as others. So when you're in school, the idea is that, it's kind of the same concept that we have for our dogs, is that the more people and the more dogs you introduce your dog to when they're young, the more tolerant they'll be when they get older. So that's what the jigsaw cooperation is all about. It's all about like reaching across the divide and making friendships.
All right. Well, speaking of dogs, let's talk about dogs. We actually have someone here who would like to learn a little more about himself. Chico. Yes, Chico.
Hello, Chico.
Hello, Chico.
Hey, Chico. So, Chico, this is Brian and Vanessa, and they are dog experts. And yes, we have a little bit of peanut butter for you to calm down.
So
we really love how you're into animals, dogs and bonobos being two of our favorites, as well as the human animal, because we are animals too. We humans are definitely animals, and we often forget that we are. And maybe that's one of the sources of a lot of human problems, is forgetting that we are animals, just like Chico here. And having a dog, being with a dog, often puts you in touch with your animal nature. And of course, dogs are very in touch with humans. And so tell us a little bit about that. Brian, you were raised by a Labrador retriever, I understand, just like Romulus and Remus were raised by a wolf. So you should know.
Yeah, we love dogs, but we also are interested in understanding dogs, because they can teach us a lot about ourselves, just like you were saying. One of the things we've learned is the secret to the success of dogs is their, and it's not a surprise to anybody, their social genius, their ability to understand us, to communicate in ways that other animals don't. But the reason they're able to do that is because they're tolerant and they're very attracted and interested in being near us and bonding with us in a way that other species are not. So it goes back to that friendliness that is the key to their cooperative relationship with us. And we know that through evolution, through the process of domestication, that Chico and every other dog like Chico actually went under selection, and they were selected to be friendly and interested and want to bond with humans, and so, or become very good at bonding with humans, I should say. And so that's what allows them to then be able to communicate and solve problems with us in ways that other animals can't.
And anything in particular about Pomeranians?
Being gorgeous. I mean,
you're a gorgeous
dog. What a
darling.
Perfect dog for you and your show. Gorgeous in personality, gorgeous in what they look like. I mean, come on.
And smart. Although,
and smart.
I guess there's a genius to every kind of dog, right? Just like there kind of is to every kind of human.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
And dogs have this, what you call, theory of mind, where they can sort of read your mind.
Brian, you take
Vanessa, you.
Oh, okay.
You want?
Well, yeah, sure. So dogs do have the ability to read the, to have thoughts and feelings and beliefs about the thoughts, feelings, and beliefs of others. So they have these theory of mind abilities, and that's really comes down to reading your body language, reading your intentions when it comes to your body language. You know, Chico, just sitting so adorably on your lap, knows that you're trying to help him and that you're trying to give him peanut butter. And that is one of the keys to the strength of our relationship, is that, you know, dogs can tell when you're trying to help them. And especially when you're trying to help them towards a goal that they have. And that's something that even chimpanzees and bonobos struggle with. Oh, no, wait, Brian, can bonobos do it? I know chimpanzees struggle.
You mean the cooperative communicative part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, in some of the games we play that are based on games we play with kids, with infants, and that's how we know that dogs are doing something unusual, is that they're passing some tests for cooperative communication that human infants pass right as they begin to acquire language. And chimpanzees and bonobos are not very good at those games. So dogs are really unusual in their ability to understand us.
Well, as you say, dogs survive by communicating with people. Bonobos aren't dependent on people to survive, and certainly common chimps aren't, and yet dogs are. I mean, wolves, they're on their own, and hey, it's sad, really sad. We love wolves, but wolves are highly endangered, and dogs are not. And dogs are not endangered because they've learned to communicate with humans, to get us to take care of them. I mean, one of the reasons I think humans love dogs is we feel we can control dogs, like we can't control each other. But really, the dogs are controlling us in a way, getting us to take care of them and give them a purpose in life. And their domestication is what has enabled them to survive and thrive, these wonderful doggies, right?
they are the second most successful mammal on the planet besides us. So friendliness for them has definitely been a good strategy. And to your point, I've been scooping up poop all day long. We have a little puppy here, and I've got, what were we doing, Brian? We were getting up at like 2, 4, 6 in the morning, take her out to the bathroom. Yeah, there is not another human I would do that for besides my children. So
and we don't even eat them. It's not like raising farm animals for our own purposes.
Useless. You can't eat them. They don't really do anything. I mean, what do they really bring to the table? Just their, you know, love without judgment.
Love. And cuddles.
Acceptance and without expectations.
Yeah, a lot of
giving
things.
Mindfully. So, you know, if you value those things.
And I just want to have you say where dogs got this way, because I used to always think humans had, you know, domesticated dogs, like around the time we started farming that we domesticated dogs. But that's not the case. Dogs domesticated themselves so that they could be near us and get all of our wonderful garbage.
So, you should know. Yeah, no, that's right. So at some point, late in human evolution, probably between 15 and 40,000 years ago, wolves were interacting with a population of humans in a new, different way. They became attracted to the humans. They wanted to be near humans, which is really counterintuitive because humans have, at this stage, have very good weapons and are competing for food with wolves. But as they began to be attracted to humans, then there was an amazing opportunity to eat garbage and scraps and all sorts of other things. And it would be regularly available. And so all you had to do was get over your fear and be attracted to humans, and you'd have access to all that new food. And so that was the selection pressure. That was the friendliness of being attracted to humans that then led to the beginning of domestication. And why Chico's sitting in your lap right now is 15 to 40,000 years ago, some wolves decided, hey, you know what? I'm just going to go get some garbage instead of go hunting.
You hear that, little wolf? It's the garbage. And yes, Chico loves garbage. He will go after garbage all the time, all over the floor. Okay, so we'll come back to dogs. But let's talk about bonobos. I found bonobos for myself when I first saw them on a PBS special. It was 1993. And I thought, wow, they're so sexual and peaceful and female empowered. I just thought everyone would fall in love with bonobos and they would become the next big thing. And boy, was I wrong. I am just amazed. I guess I misjudged the puritanical propensity of the media and academia. But certainly when you guys got involved in like 2010 or something, or 2008, you did turn that around in your very wholesome, family-oriented way. You said, yes, bonobos are really cool. And yes, they have a lot of sex, but they also do these other things. But yes, they have a lot of sex. That was a turning point.
Well, we're just so grateful to you, Susie, because you really just paved the way for us. You are one of their longest and most original supporters, even back before anybody was talking about bonobos. And just to clarify, bonobos are actually very famous in France. The French love bonobos. Then bonobos are more well known over there than chimpanzees. It does seem to be the English Western media that seems to be a little bit hesitant to talk about bonobos and sex. But as you said, there's lots of animals that have sex, and bonobos just have sex in just a really super friendly and creative way. And that's not even the most interesting thing about them.
Speak for yourself, Vanessa. I'll just interrupt for a second, because I remember Brian also said on Christopher Ryan's show that he told Anderson Cooper, you know, sex is not the most interesting thing about bonobos, because of course Anderson is horny like me. So he's like, let me see him have sex. And so I'm also interested in that, partly because I'm a sex therapist, but also, yeah, sex is interesting. And I think a lot of people find it interesting. And that is what makes some people interested in bonobos. Maybe not other people, like people that are speaking officially. They don't want to come across like they're a sex maniac. But a lot of people are interested because of the sex. And then, of course, there is the most interesting thing about bonobos, which is that they've never been seen killing each other in the wild or captivity. This is really interesting because common chimps do kill each other. They even make a kind of war. And gorillas have infanticide. Orangutans kill each other not so much, but sometimes. But bonobos never do. Humans do, of course, a tremendous amount, the most. But the fact that bonobos don't is really amazing considering how close they are to us. And they seem to use that sex in order to keep the peace. So
yeah, sex is really a bonding mechanism in bonobos. It's a strategy to avoid conflict and to feel together, to feel friendly. And that's why we call it the bonobo handshake, because it's not a big deal for them. It's like, hey, you know, how are you? I'm friendly, you're friendly, we're going to be friends, and this is how we're going to do it. And so, you know, when two groups of chimpanzees meet each other, if they're strangers and from different territories, as you said, it can get really violent really quickly. But bonobos, they just, you know, they meet two large groups, they'll have sex, they'll share food, they'll hang out and just travel with each other for a couple
right.
of days.
They really do teach us about sharing, about how natural it is to share. And yeah, they do share sex, and I'm not saying we should all be sharing so much sex, although maybe we should. But I guess what I'm saying is it's good to recognize that that's a part of who we are. And also to recognize that when we say sex with bonobos, we're mostly not talking about intercourse. We're mostly not talking about what led to those babies. We're talking about what I call outer course, what some people might call foreplay or frottage. I like the term outer course just because it makes it clear that this is a form of caressing, touching, licking, rubbing, massaging that really doesn't involve much penetration, but is very sexual and very orgasmic. Some primatologists have said, well, then it's not sex if it's not intercourse, but I think it is. Being a sex therapist, I know that what gives most humans pleasure is usually not the old in and out, but all the other stuff.
Dolphins, too. I think the official scientific term for it is sociosexual behavior. So it's a sex that is...
I like outer course better, sorry.
Okay. Susie gets better with words than scientists.
Well, we can use both. The whole genital rubbing that the females do, and they are all very, I guess, bisexual or pansexual bonobos. So the females rub against each other. One primatologist didn't call that sex, but I call that sex. Scissoring is something that has been called. And they have orgasms from doing that. And I like the Mogondu term, hoka hoka, better than genital rubbing.
Well, and so on GG rubbing, I mean, the other thing is to understand is that their genitalia has actually evolved. So females have, their clitorises have evolved to be more ventral facing. And it actually aids in their ability to rub together. So chimpanzee clitorises are more dorsally facing, and they don't have the ability to pleasure each other in the same way. Anyone who would say that it's not somehow sexual is missing the point, because why would there be anatomical change if that wasn't something that was dramatically important to the species? And so they certainly, you know, rub their clitorises vigorously, have orgasm, and, you know, it could be quite intense when you see it. You know, obviously we haven't been able to measure and how would you even demonstrate that another species has an orgasm? But there's no reason to think that they're not. And the other thing that's really a couple of interesting things. Vanessa famously and I did a study. I think you must have talked about. Maybe you talked about it on that stuff you interviewed. Is bonobos are really born ready or prepared to have these social sexual interactions or outer course, because even young infants are already prepared and do these behaviors as a bonding technique to facilitate friendship. And then the last thing is that when there are new groups of bonobos that meet each other, neighbors that are maybe strange to each other, famously they'll have sexual interactions with each other. But what's a new finding is that if there's an immigrant female who moves into a new group of bonobos, if it was a chimpanzee, the females would attack her. They would violently try to have her move away back out of their group. But bonobo females, that female actually becomes the preferred sociosexual partner, and the preferred female is the new female
who
joins
the
group.
The new girl in town, hey. Yeah. I want to speak to two points there. First of all, in terms of, you know, the babies, and yes, they do have sex, a kind of outer course type sex. I just want to say, I believe that the bonobos are great inspiration to humans. That's the bonobo way, is to inspire us to be more sex positive, more peaceful, more female empowered, and more cognizant of male well-being. But that doesn't mean bonobos are a blueprint for how humans should be. Not at all. We shouldn't live in trees. Well, some of us maybe. But we shouldn't be having sex with our children. And bonobos do that. And so we have to be able to understand that they do things that we don't do and that we shouldn't do. And yet, they are still an inspiration to us. And that's important. Okay, now that I got out of that, I want to...
bonobos do not, that's good. And to be clear, bonobos don't have norms, social norms. They don't have morality like we do. I couldn't agree with you, more
right.
strongly.
They don't have morality like we do. But they have a certain, I guess, ethical hedonism. They don't kill. That's their morality. One very important point of morality. And okay, Chico, we're talking about bonobos now, not about you, so you can go. Bonobos, as you were saying, are also very baby dominant. I mean, I think of them as female empowered. And the babies have a lot of power because the females have a lot of power. Or maybe you could say the females have a lot of power because they respect the babies so much. But it's all very connected, isn't it?
You put it so well. They are female empowered and baby dominant. If there is a baby in the group that wants something, that baby will get it. And so it is just this kind of like topsy-turvy chimpanzee world in bonobo land where they really do treasure their babies. And, you know, and that means that unlike all the other great apes, that the infants won't be harmed or killed. And that is because the females have such strong bonds that they're able to defend their babies against any kind of male aggression. And this is very unusual. And just to your earlier point, you know, bonobos are not a model for humans. What they are is that they have a mechanism in order to overcome any kind of violent tendencies of males in the group, between each other. They have a mechanism to diffuse tension. And I think that's what we really need.
And that is what is so important. And when you first went to the Democratic Republic of Congo, you were trying to find out, like, what is going on with human war? Your father had been in the Vietnam War, and that had a profound impact on you, as it had on a lot of people. And all these wars have terrible impacts on people. And you went there to find out, in part, also you went there because your husband Brian was going there, but you also wanted to understand war, and you discovered these fabulous creatures that do not make war.
It was such a perfect contrast because, you know, the most peaceful species in the world lives in one of the most war-torn countries. And it's true, that's something that humans do. There's war everywhere. It's not just one part of the world. I mean, the Democratic Republic of Congo's war was particularly awful, but because of all the international actors like Australia and the US and, you know, France and the rest of Europe. So, I mean, just to have this animal that I'd never heard of, I wasn't like you, Susie, I came to bonobos quite late, but to know that this was this great ape that shared 98.7% of our DNA and had managed to short circuit this tendency we have to kill each other was just so fascinating to me. And I wanted to, you know, find out more about them and figure out how they were doing it. Something that, you know, for all our technology and all our intelligence, we haven't managed to do yet.
So just briefly, I mean, a lot of people might wonder, why are they like this? And we don't fully know, but Dr. Richard Wrangham and maybe some other people came up with this idea of the food abundance that was the lot for bonobos, because bonobos were on a certain side of the Congo River and the common chimps were on the other side. And when they split off, bonobos stayed in this rainforest of abundance, and therefore the females could afford to hang out together and not be so competitive, and the males could afford not to be so competitive. These bonobos developed this peace through pleasure, as I call it, society in this land of honey and milk and abundance.
Yeah, it really is true. I mean, Vanessa has seen, and I have seen quite often, where there's some kind of disagreement, and in chimpanzee land, there would be a horrible fight, and instead, bonobos end up, as you say, having a pleasurable experience together, and as the Congolese say, they negotiate using sex, and then they don't have a fight and they go off and, you know, everything's fine again. So I have, you know, it is hard to not be astounded and, as you said, inspired by the fact that they could use this as their mechanism. And I hate to return to the babies again, but I just have to tell a couple of, you know, news stories. And this isn't, this is about how babies are dominant, in that it's incredible because we did find that some of the most dominant individuals in bonobo groups are the infants. And the reason is because I like your baby bonobo. if an infant bonobo is in trouble, all of the females come to protect them. And one of the other, this is a brand new finding from Wamba, and it goes to their friendliness with strangers, is for the first time ever, bonobos were observed adopting orphan infants from other groups who had been abandoned. The females took them and raised them as their own, because infants are so central in protecting infants. And so you were asking the question, well, how did this peaceful society come to be? And Richard had, Professor Rango has this idea about food. The mechanism we think that played a role is sexual selection, that females had more food and that allowed them to have friendships. They could protect their babies in a way that chimpanzee females can't, and it empowered them exactly as you said, and they could then have a preference for friendlier males, and females prefer friendlier males.
We do. They do. We do. We do too, I think. Human females do too. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, so bonobo females have a really strong preference for friendly males who are not aggressive towards babies or towards the other females. So that's why the friendliest males, it ends up that all the females prefer the same male. And male bonobos that are successful and preferred by the females actually have more offspring than the most successful, big, powerful, despotic chimpanzee. So that's what we think happened, is that females were empowered, and through sexual selection, they preferred friendly males, and friendly males passed on their genes for friendliness, and you ended up with a species of incredibly friendly, non-aggressive males who use sexual behavior as part of their way to stay peaceful.
Yes, nice guys finish first. And I just want to say those bonobo males, they're very friendly with the females. They have a lot of MILFs, friends of their mother, who have sex with them. Their mother doesn't, actually. That's the one relationship that, where they don't actually have intercourse. But I guess they do a lot of hugging and stuff. But they do have sex with mom's friends. And, of course, as you said earlier, the new lady in town is always very popular. And when they fight, they have sex with each other, okay? There's this kind of thing they do, penis fencing. We love that here in Bonoboville, our Bonoboville. And butt rubbing, rump rubbing, I guess. They don't say butt, they say rump rubbing. And these guys, they're, you know, they're kind of gay the bonobo way. I mean, they're, I guess, pansexual. They, just like the females will use sex for kind of political, social reasons, the bonobo males use sex, too, for their own political, social conflict resolution reasons.
Well, a lot of, so, oh, sorry, go ahead, Vanessa.
Oh, I was just about to say sex is a great tension reliever. I think that's what we've all learned. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, and I was going to say the same thing, but slightly more scientifically, and just say one of the things we found when we were comparing chimpanzees and bonobos is that counterintuitively, bonobos are more anxious than chimpanzees. They become socially anxious more easily.
Yeah.
And because they become socially, and they get more socially anxious when they're separated from other bonobos, or if there's any kind of tension in the group, they get really anxious. And how they then relieve that stress is they often then have some kind of sexual behavior with one another. And in chimpanzees, that's just not what happens. They have an increase in testosterone. They don't get anxious. They just get really pumped up and want to
fight.
Potentially be aggressive and fight.
So why don't bonobos make enemies of bonobos from other tribes? I mean, we're talking about that flip side of friendliness. And humans are extremely friendly, but we also have our mean side when we perceive someone to be of an outgroup, another human. Now, when bonobos connect with another bonobo from another tribe, they want to have sex, share food. Sometimes they're more interested in the stranger than they are in the friend. So what's up with that? And can we do that too?
So we think that humans, what was really special about us that actually led to us being successful is that we formed a new social category that actually no other animal has. And that is of an intra-group stranger. So someone you see who is a stranger that you know is somehow part of your group. Because bonobos and chimpanzees and all other animals, it's really simple. If you've never seen someone before, or they live in another part of the territory, or if they're new, they're a stranger. But what we've been able to do is we can just look at someone and instantaneously sort of like categorize them on all these different fronts in like the blink of an eye. And we make judgments about whether or not they are one of us.
Of course,
and
we could be wrong about those judgments.
We could be totally wrong, but you can't. But you see them, and if you see them as being one of you, you're instantly prepared to make friends with them. And that is an intra-group stranger. But the flip side, as Brian was talking about, is that if you feel that this stranger is somehow a threat to your group, then you can be immediately aggressive. So bonobos see all new strangers as friends, and chimpanzees see all new strangers usually with trepidation and behave aggressively towards them. But so that's the difference between chimpanzees and bonobos. But with humans, we have this new social category that's really weird, and it allows us to make friends and enemies really quickly.
Yeah, so I think that's one way in which I'd like to take the bonobos as an inspiration. I mean, not that you can trust anybody, really. Your own family member could shoot you one day if you have enough ammunition stored in the garage. But back to sex. We do tend to have a sexual attraction for strangers. We have an attraction for the exotic. We want the new. We're curious, we humans. And I think that our society, whether it's our parents or our religion or our government, our in-group leaders say, no, you shouldn't trust the stranger. And I do think maybe there is a little more push from these hierarchical powers over us to try to tamp down our somewhat natural tendency to be attracted to the strange, to the new, to the exotic. And maybe we need to stimulate that again.
Yeah, so I think that this goes back to what we talked about at the beginning is the real powerful elixir to all these challenges are cross-group friendships that can be bridges across groups. And we are attracted to the strangers. We are attracted to, and, you know, exotic is erotic, you know. And so if we know that in every human there's this tendency to be attracted to strangers, but then also the flip side of that, then we can combat it. And you have to say to yourself, no, wait a second, I'm maybe having one of these responses and I should actually go introduce myself, or I should be a little bit more patient, or you know, maybe I should just try to be friendly and maybe we'll be end up being friends and I'll find out that this is a wonderful person in a way that I didn't know.
Knowledge is power, and sexual knowledge is sexual power. And yes, this book definitely gives us a lot of powerful knowledge about our good tendencies and our bad tendencies and how we can emphasize the good. Are there any peace studies departments that study the way bonobos make peace? I see all these peace studies. I see primatology separate from peace studies. Why is that?
That is a very astute observation. I'm so impressed with you. You have the cutting mind of a scientist. Maybe that's why you're so good at your job. But you're right. Social psychology was really started after World War II, really to try and make sense of what happened. You know, how is it that people could do such terrible things for each other? So that's when social psychology really took off. And, you know, primatology, of course, has been going on for a lot longer. And I think people feel uncomfortable with recognizing ourselves as great apes. And I think one of the reasons for that is the Uncanny Valley. They're so similar to us, but not quite. Like, so the Uncanny Valley is one example. Is if you see a robot and you just kind of, or you see a mannequin and they just kind of move really slowly, you get this really chilly, creeped out feeling. It's like, you know, those evil dolls. And that's because they're almost, but not quite human. Mm. So I think that we feel the way towards great apes differently to all other animals because, you know, you see a dolphin or you see like a meerkat and you're like, oh my gosh, it's adorable. But great apes, they're so similar to us and they're not quite. Right. So they make us extremely uncomfortable at times.
That's true. And you bring that up in your book and it really resonated with me because I've been giving talks about bonobos and the bonobo way for many years. And I feel like recently I've had more people saying that they're a little upset at the simianization, that I'm comparing bonobos and all apes to humans and even saying, well, humans are apes actually. And some people are offended by that. You have both the religious right who's offended by that because, well, they just think the world was created in 7 days. And then you have the woke left that somehow sees our connection to apes as being, I don't know, I guess racist.
Yeah, so I think all of that is true. And I think what Vanessa with the Uncanny Valley touched on is that, you know, great apes historically, gorillas, chimpanzees, orangutans, not as much bonobos, but all the other species have been used to put other groups of people down by using caricatures or using a comparison to great apes as an insult.
Right.
And so there's a long history of that. And unfortunately, it is pernicious. And so I think that's when you're, you know, I think it's, I think we're, more used to and more familiar with sort of a response, people who would be, you know, fundamental Christian or something, be uncomfortable. But on the more liberal side, where people are trying to be anti-racist, et cetera, I think that's where that's coming from, is the historical use of great apes. But that doesn't mean there's not space for celebrating bonobos and other, and the fact that we are great apes, and that there's, you know, good science to suggest that great apes can teach us a way to do better than what we've done before. So I'm with you, and it can be frustrating and, you know, and also confusing as to what exactly, how to navigate those troubled waters. So yeah. but you, I mean, just to share Vanessa's praise, I think you have done such an amazing job as a communicator and a science communicator, and helped so many people. So we're so thankful to you, and also all the support you always give Lola Yabonobo too.
Speaking of Lola Yabonobo, let's just talk for a few minutes about the state of bonobo conservation and where we're at. Bonobos are so highly endangered, and we have to save them if we're going to study them. And so how are we doing with that?
So we're on the board of an organization called Friends of Bonobos, and that is based in the U.S., and its main purpose is to support the bonobo sanctuary in Congo, and also to do what you've been doing, is just to raise awareness of bonobos, make people understand how special they are, and then also giving people actionable items on how they can help bonobos. Because, you know, as the saying goes, you conserve what you love. And we're hoping that people will fall in love with bonobos just as we have and just as you have. And through education and raising awareness, we think that has come a long way, and that will become even more powerful in the future.
Well, absolutely. We're trying to save these wonderful creatures, and they are also susceptible to the COVID-19 virus, and so we have to protect them from that. I know they got their shots here at the San Diego Zoo. I hope they're being protected at Lola somehow. We're going to have a list of bonobo organizations on here where you can give your money and maybe volunteer your time. What do you think about Elon Musk saying bonobos are his favorite creature? Did you hear him say that?
I hadn't heard him say that. That's wonderful.
On the Joe Rogan show, he said it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or when there's the bonobos.
Yeah.
They got a better philosophy.
Yeah, they're like swingers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really are.
Bill Gates, too.
Describe yourself using an animal. What animal would it be?
Bonobo.
So you should contact him, see if he wants to support Lola.
I'll text him. I'll definitely text. I'll what is it? I'll Snapchat. What are the kids doing these days, Brian? Do you
the
Slacking or something?
This is your second book together, right?
Yes.
It's a winning combination. Married. What is your secret to writing success before we go? I need marriage, Brian. Keeping your marriage together.
Forgiveness.
Fast reconciliation.
You do it like bonobos with a little loud,
yes,
of course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it doesn't always end that happily.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you guys are geniuses. Geniuses is certainly at being friendly and certainly at writing and presenting. You've just had a genius for doing this interview. I've really had such a good time, and the time has flown. Is there anything that you wanted to add to our conversation?
We love you, Susie.
Just to prove I'm in the mountains. Nice sunset here. Let's see.
Oh, look at that. Beautiful. Out there in the woods. Do you ever say when you guys are having sex, now the hair is in the woods, you know?
No! That's the first time I've ever heard.
We will now.
I give you, I have to give you my sex therapeutic advice. That this will.
Thank you for the advice.
Okay. So, you think there's hope for humanity? Are we becoming more friendly or less friendly? I mean, here we are on screens all the time. Can we become more friendly before we kill ourselves?
Yes, yes, we have becoming more friendly. War has rapidly decreased in the last 50 years. We've had a rapid increase of democracy. We are getting better. We're getting better. We don't know if we're getting better fast enough, but there is hope. And I think that understanding our nature and, you know, aspiring to wonderful, you know, animals that we see in the world, like bonobos and dogs, of course, dogs. I think that really is the way forward.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Brian, did you have one more thing you wanted to add?
Or just a delight to meet you. And I'll see you on Twitter. I love it when we have a little conversation. So
yes.
Take care.
Okay. Take care. Love. Go bonobos.
Yeah. Yay, bonobos.
All right. Love you. All right.
I love you.
Brian and Vanessa, Dr. Brian Hare and Vanessa Woods, authors of Survival of the Friendliest, Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity. It's going to save the world, brothers and sisters, through dogs and bonobos and humans. So make like bonobos, not baboons. Make love, not war. Make love to someone you love tonight, even if that someone is you. I love you.
Great show, Dr. Susie. I really enjoyed it.
You did great.
That was really very good, Dr. Susie. Excellent.
Chico, you did very good.
Peanut butter.
Chico, you were great.
You're a star.
Honorable Chico.
Peanut butter. Here we go.
Need to talk with someone about something you can't talk about with anyone else? You can talk to us. I'm Dr. Susan Block, your mistress of the airwaves. But my day job is director of the Dr. Susan Block Institute for the Erotic Arts and Sciences, specializing in sex therapy over the phone. Anytime you need to talk, whether you need serious psychotherapy or a hot phone sex experience or a combination, my world-renowned telephone sex therapists are just a phone call away. Totally private, absolutely confidential. We listen, talk with you, advise you, role play for you, fantasize with you. No fantasy is too taboo, and help you with anything from impotence to exhibitionism, fears to desires, fetishes to marriages. For more information, call us at 213-291-9497. That's 213-291-9497 anytime you need to talk.
You're listening to Radio Suzy One on the World Wide Web.